So I think we can actually start on time, and Arnie doesn't need any introduction.
So some of you will be old enough to remember that Richard Feynman taught Introduction to Physics at Caltech to undergraduates. And that was around the time, actually, he also worked for a 3-year sabbatical in the biology lab, and actually was one of the first people to uncover messenger RNAs in E. coli, actually. When Feynman taught Introduction to Physics, he did it in his inimitable style of turning things around. I learned physics starting with the inclined plane and forces, right? And Newtonian physics. He started with quantum theory. And he always started with a classic experiment, which he then tried to take more than half the cost to explain. And this was the experiment of having a light source and having a filter with a hole in it. And the light went through the single hole, and you could count the quanta on the other side, or even in the hole, you could actually put a machine and count the quanta on the other side of light, demonstrating the particle nature and the discrete nature of light. And then you close that hole, open up another hole, and then you count the quanta on the other hole. Then you open them up together, and for the first time now you get destructive and constructive interference, and you see the waves. Right. And this was, of course, an introduction, experimental introduction, to the role of the observer in quantum theory, and that what you observe is what you get, and what the observer is measuring is what you get, and that light could take a duality of forms. And he used that as his way of introducing physics to undergraduates at Caltech, which is an amazing way to get started in physics. So I tried, and actually I was a postdoc at Caltech, 66 to 68, and sat in on Introduction to Physics by Feynman, because it was such a classic course that a lot of postdocs sat in on those courses. And I got in about 6 or 8 lectures before the mathematics defeated me, and I pulled out, but the undergraduates, of course, stayed the whole track. But he was a really interesting lecturer in the way he began things. And I tried to think of what's the equivalent experiment in cancer biology that has hidden in it all of the things we took 40 years to learn, and which really has a fundamental understanding about the cell and cancer biology. And there is actually such an experiment. I gave you the reference to it. It's an experiment carried out by a guy named Leonard Hayflick. Leonard Hayflick was at the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia at the time. And it was in the late 50s, early 60s. 60, I think, is the publication of what's now called the Hayflick experiment. And at the time, people were very concerned with getting cells from the body of organisms, humans or mice or any animals, and bringing them into petri dishes so that you could get a handle on how to study these cells out of the organism and into the petri dishes. And the great success had come 10 years earlier, in 1950 or so, at Johns Hopkins, where a cervical cancer from a woman. There's a book on this, actually. Henrietta Laux is her name. And the cervical cancer was taken out, grown in petri dishes and tissue culture, and it grew forever. It grows to this day, right? And the cervical cancer is called HeLa cells, named for Henrietta Laux. And she, of course, and that cell actually is, we'll come back and revisit that cell, because it's hidden in that cell is a virus, which causes the cancer. And which, of course, no one knew about at the time. But we'll come back and visit that when we talk about virus. So there were a few cells in culture. They were mostly cancer cells, and they grew really well in cell culture. Not all cancer cells, but a few. But people wanted normal cells. They didn't want cancer cells, right? So Hayflick did the following experiment. He took what would be the youngest, I don't know who the youngest person in the audience is, but you like cells, I know, because you told me yesterday you don't want me to talk about molecules, you want me to talk about cells, so I started that way. So you look young enough, I will go to you, and I'll have this throw car, right? I have this rather big pick, right? And I stick it into your arm, and I pull out the tissue, right? And I get your upper layer of epithelial cells, which actually are not going to grow in culture, and the lower layer of fibroblasts, right? So your skin is made up of epithelial cells, which actually are constantly in division. Your skin is turning over all the time. And this constant division is producing differentiated cells with a very tough, dead set of cells at the surface, keratins, and they slough off. So you're constantly dividing and sloughing off cells, and that's your skin. Below it is a membrane they live on, and a group of cells called fibroblast cells, which make the membrane. They make fibrous material, fibroblasts, that's what they're named that way. They're mesenchymal cells, for those of you who know about the germ layers. And those cells grow very well in culture for a peculiar reason. Right? So if you want to grow cells in culture, you have to have a medium. The medium has all the right amino acids, it has the nutrients, it has glucose, it has everything, and you add 10% serum. Serum is the protein components of the blood. And in fact, you add what we use today is something called fetal calf serum. It's the serum from fetal cows that are giving birth, the fetuses, and it's very rich in growth factors. Why? Because the embryos are growing very fast. And so these growth factors, you'll find out in a few minutes, are absolutely essential to one of the two triggers for cell division. There are two ways in which cells have to get two signals to grow. This is signaling, if you like this, right? Cells have to get two signals to grow. One signal is a growth factor, and that's usually a protein. And the other signal is a nutrient signal, right? Now, that's true for all cells. That's true for any older, evolutionarily older cells. Yeast, for example, only require the growth factor signals. So if the environment is rich in glucose and rich in amino acids and a nitrogen source, that's enough for yeast. They don't need anything else. But for human cells and mouse cells and vertebrate cells, you need these two simultaneous signals. One is growth factor, right? And the reason fibroblasts grow is a very, we never knew this until later on, but very peculiar reason is that when we bleed somebody, let's say I wanted to get a serum from you guys, when I bleed you, I put a needle in, and I take the blood out. Sounds awful, isn't it? And then these platelets, these small clotting factors burst, and they put out something called platelet-derived growth factor. That's a very clever strategy if you think about it, because when you're wounded, your platelets not only layer in to stop the bleeding, but they put out platelet-derived growth factor, and platelet-derived growth factor is a growth factor for fibroblasts, which make your skin, your wound healing work very fast, right? So it's a great strategy, that's it. But that's in the medium, and that's why I'm going to talk about fibroblasts, because we take serum, and serum has platelet-derived growth factor. So what's growing is fibroblasts. That's important. Roughly become important for you to know. So Hayflick decided he would do this with normal fibroblasts. So he looked at his audience, he took the youngest person, he took the cells from the youngest person, and he put them in tissue culture, and the fibroblasts grew out, and he kept passaging them, because they keep dividing, you run into a limit of the scale of the petri dish you're in. So what you do is reduce it 1 to 10, and then you pass it again, 1 to 10, and you pass it again, and you go through divisions, right? And what he observed was a peculiar effect. If this was the zero generation, the time you put them in culture, I'm going to plot the number of generations the cells go through, the number of division processes they go through, versus the time, the generation time, the rate at which they're dividing, right? Okay? And so on the average, cells will divide at rates of 20 to 24 hours. Okay? Now, I have to tell you, we'll go backwards in time, and I will tell you that when we talk about metabolism, under the optimal growth condition, cells can divide every 7 hours. They have the capability of really cranking up. But under these growth conditions, they divide about every 24 hours. And what Hayflick saw was a curve that looked like this. And it went to infinity in the sense that the cells completely stopped growing. And roughly the time that they started to slow down was generation 60. And roughly by generation 70 to 80, they had stopped growing. And this was reproducible with everyone in the audience. So everyone in this audience I could take, and I would get roughly the same thing, right? In other words, your cells have, in cell culture, a limited lifespan. That's what Hayflick would say. And these cells completely stop growing, right? because the number independent of the person, the number of generations was always 70 to 80, right? And this was very reproducible. Hayflick said, gee, these cells have a clock. They count the number of generations, right? So now you can test that idea, that Hayflick made a hypothesis, they have a clock, they're counting generations. So how do you test that idea? Well, one way to test the idea that they're counting generations is, out about here, at about generation 40, I'm going to take these cells and I'm going to freeze them down. I take them out, I freeze them down, I put them at minus 70 degrees where they're stored. They're metabolizing at an extremely low rate. They're not dividing, certainly, right? And they're stored. And I keep them there for 10 years. I pull them back out, and they go another 30 to 40 generations, and they stop. Right? So this isn't the chronological clock. This is a biological clock for counting divisions, right? Because chronologically, you could interrupt the process for 10 years, and you wouldn't have a problem, right? Then they did a very clever experiment. They asked, is this clock a peculiarity of tissue culture, or is it happening in you? In other words, do your cells in vivo, this is in vitro, this is in cell culture, have a biological clock, that counting generations? Now we're beginning to shift the conversation to longevity, right? Okay, so a pretty good experiment that was done was to take a newborn. Now, you wouldn't want to take a newborn and stick a trocar in it and take the cells out, but fortunately, circumcisions do the same thing, right? So you can take the circumcision, and the fibroblasts will grow out of those cells, and you put them in culture, and now zero time is really zero time, right? Well, it depends on the law, right? I mean, but zero time is really at birth, right? And it goes 70 to 80 generations and stops. Now I want to look for the oldest person in the audience, right? So let's say we take a 65-year-old, 70-year-old person, right? Now we have the clock gone 65 to 70 years in vivo. And I'll take the cells out, right? And then the curve will look like this. It will have a shorter number of counts and generations, right? So this clock is on in you, right? This isn't the biological artifact of cell culture. Counting the number of cell divisions is happening in vivo as well as in vitro, right? And I've already given you, slipped by you, something very early on by saying that when I took a cancer cell out and we had a Lauxa cell, the cancer cell did this. Oh, I have color, so I can be very colorful about this. The cancer cell never stopped. So now I've actually learned something also about cancer. Cancer is immortal by this assay. Your normal cells are mortal, and the mortality is in a clock that's being carried by you. Right? Now this is one of the favorite, set of observations are one of the favorite things that people who study longevity, the control of lifespan, are interested in, right? Because it suggests that you have a limited lifespan because you have a limited number of cell divisions. Yep. So let me say, you are more than welcome to interrupt, I expect it. Because I almost finished with the lecture.
So for the dashed line, how many divisions do fibroblast cells perform during our lifetime if you live 80 years?
We don't really know that answer, but if what we count in cell culture is an indication, it's about 80 divisions.
So once a year?
Oh, no. Your skin, I just told you, is turning over once a week, right? But let me say that you have many different cells, right? So you have a population of cells, right? Uh-huh. So it doesn't mean that one could go 80 generations and then it could switch to another set of cells which go 80 generations and switch to another set of cells which go 80 generations. So it isn't the count isn't, in fact, limiting your lifespan. You don't live 80 days. Right? If it divides once a day. And the reason you don't live 80 days is because what I'm going to now refer to as a stem cell, right? A cell that has a count on that's reproducing your whole skin, right? That cell will be a population of cells, not one cell. Okay? So in other words, by the time you get to, since progression is geometric, by the time you get to a certain level, right, you can seed stem cells for a very long time and live for a very long time.
So there's some kind of a tree that you have some stem cells.
I'm going to get to the mechanisms behind this, which will then tell you why. For example, this is I've already placed a terrible enigma in your path, right? I've been talking about your mortality, right? But in some sense, you're immortal, right? In the sense that you make germ cells, which go on forever, right? So the sperm and eggs go on forever. So this can't be true for sperm and eggs, or there has to be a normal way around it. And there is the ways around it become what cancer's about. Right.
So, yeah. Does it mean that this clock is setting up when cells differentiate?
No, it means that when cells divide.
So no, but I mean, undifferentiated cells don't have this clock.
No, undifferentiated cells do have this clock.
So this clock is,
this clock starts at day one, at fertilization. This clock will...
How does one know that?
I'll tell you how. I promise. I mean, you'll be satisfied with the answer after I tell you the answer, right? I mean, the clock has a physical basis, right, like any clock does, and I'm going to tell you what it is in a minute.
And for plants, if you take like...
plants are really peculiar. They get around this by not having immortality, right? Plants have immortality. They don't have a mortal lifespan.
How about other organisms? I remember something
the mice will put the big riddle on this on top.
Right. So there's an experiment that's just been referred to that's kind of interesting if this is correct. We're talking about animals. We've excluded plants, right? So, Galapagos turtles live 200 years. You guys live 80 years on the average, right? Dogs live 7 to 14 years. Mice live 2 years, right? So suppose we took cells from Galapagos turtles, humans, dogs and mice, right? Would they actually have this kind of stratification? The answer is yes, they do. So Galapagos turtles will go many more than 80 generations, right? We go about 80, dogs will go about 40, 30. Mice actually go about 5 or 6 generations, and actually all hell breaks loose, but you'll see that breaking loose here too in a minute, okay? So actually, this is set up pretty interestingly. There's a correlation with longevity, although it's not the only factor in longevity. There's a correlation with in vivo clock, in vitro clock. There's a difference between cancer and normal. This is an interesting experiment once we start to understand it and analyze it. Yeah.
Is the basal generation time always the same in cancer?
Let me go back to cells, right? So I've just taken you through a population experiment, right? I could take movies and watch individual cells, right? And one of the really interesting things is individual cells die all along the way, right? That's this in vivo, that's your experiment in some way, right? If I took a million cells from you, they'd be at all stages in this population issue, right? Some of them would be old, some of them would be young. Right? And you see that. You see individual cells dying all along the way. It's just that more and more die, and now the rate of the population increases, right? The rate of division time increases, because you're watching more and more die and fail to divide. So less and less are participating in division, and the overall average rate starts to drop. This is generation time, it's a reciprocal of time rate. Okay. All right, so...
How is the distribution? Is it a short distribution or is it very broad?
Although I'm going to show you in a minute or two how to predict that in any population. Right? Okay. So this actually came to be called mortality or mortality one, and it came to be called mortality one in infinite stopping, right? Because there was a way to reverse it. Right. So in the 60s we had started to discover viruses which caused cancer. So there was a particular virus, it's a monkey virus called simian virus 40. It's actually quite an interesting virus because it's in monkey cells. Those were the cells that were used for the polio vaccine. So anyone from 1953 to 1960 who got the polio vaccine, that's me, that's probably you, right? 53 to 60 who got the polio vaccine also got this virus, this contaminant, right? Called simian virus 40. Scared the hell out of the pharmaceutical industry when they took that virus, put it into hamsters, and it made cancers, made tumors, right? So there's something about this virus that makes tumors. Let me just say a word about this virus, and then this afternoon we're going to talk about viruses in more detail, because something like 25% of all human cancers are caused by viruses, right? And there's what's closely related to this virus in humans that it does cause a cancer, right? But this one doesn't, right, in humans. This virus is simple. It's 5,300 base pairs. So we say 5.3 kb, kilobases, right? 5,600 base pairs, so that's roughly its complexity. It has 6 to 8 genes. So it became the favorite toy of reductionists, of molecular biologists, to find out how cancer occurs, right? Why? Anything with 5 to 6 genes that could cause cancer told us that cancer was going to be a simple process, right? Can't be too complex. Something could cause cancer with that few genes, right? And remarkably, that cancer virus, when you infect these cells, so I'm now going to take the virus and infect the cells that are just sitting there, resting, right? And what happens is these cells all start dividing again for about 10 to 20 generations, and then they die, right? They don't rest, they die, right? They just fall apart if you look at them, right? They are a mess, okay? And in fact, what you see is their chromosomes fuse. They make an impossible template, blueprint, for life to go on because of the fusions, the breaks in the DNA, right? And all of these things that happen kill most of the cells, right? So about 5 logs or 6 logs of cells die under these conditions because there's a stochastic and random fusion of chromosomes and rearrangements that you have. If this is human, you have 23 chromosomes twice, right, which packages 3 billion, 3 times 10 to the 9th base pairs, right? Very complicated. And these 23 chromosomes start fusing and breaking, and they become, the cells that come out of this are aneuploid. They're a mess. Their chromosomes are a mess, right? However, with a kill rate of about 10 to minus 6, about a million cells are dying, and a petri dish with about 5 times 10 to the minus 6, a bunch of cells come through, right? And so with a little bit of time, rare clones come through. When I say rare clones, it's one in a million starts to come through, right? And they grow forever now. They have immortality. So I can overcome mortality. This came to be called mortality too. Right? And I can overcome mortality, and quite remarkable, right? Every cell, every cancer cell that comes through, every individual clone, every time I do the experiment, has in its chromosomes integrated the DNA of the virus SV40, and it expresses a messenger RNA, and it expresses proteins. It expresses actually 2 proteins, right? Now that was a really interesting clue. Because I remember I told you that all molecular biologists wanted to study this virus because a simple number of genes causes cancer. And here, 2 genes, 2 proteins, are associated with immortality. Right? Immortality is associated with cancer. It's not cancer, but it's associated. It's one of the phenotypes of cancer. Remember, because cancer cells are immortal. Right? So suddenly these 2 proteins which are expressed. Now, I can even do a great genetic experiment. It's possible to make mutations in this virus, right? Change the genes, right? So they create proteins which behave in a temperature-sensitive fashion. But that doesn't mean they function at 32 degrees centigrade, but they don't function at 39, right? So they are altered proteins which are thermally unstable. And at 39, they're thermally unstable, they don't function. And at 32, they're thermally stable and they function, right? And so I can take those temperature-sensitive mutants in these genes and turn them on, right? I can at 32 degrees get a cancer cell in culture, and I go to 39 and the cells stop growing and they die. Yeah.
So what I'm not sure about in your curves is you have two effects, and what's due to slowing down of actual division, and what's due to death, which basically puts some, because if you have death, it puts like
death slows the bit. So division is a product of two properties. One is the property of making cells divide, right? The synthesis of things. But it's also a property of death, right? So it's synthesis minus death, right? So when you say, what is this due to, synthesis or death, it's actually due to both. And in fact, if I was to stop here, if I said nothing more, you would now have the lesson that the genes that cause cancer are both positive synthetic genes and negative loss of death, right? So you can get cancer by losing death, right? Or you can get cancer by gaining growth, right?
So what's the relative ratio in these kind of curves?
It depends on the cancer, and it depends on the genes, right? Some genes cause death, right? So just right now, right? Gamma rays are coming through, right? This building, right? They're hitting your skin cells, right? They're breaking your DNA. A broken piece of DNA is exactly what's put you in this phase of mortality too, right? So you've got a problem because you have the beginning of a higher mutation rate than normal because of the broken DNA, right? And so the strategy that your body has adapted is to say, I've got a broken chromosome, I'm going to kill the cell, right? And you've eliminated the clone that could have mutated, right? And that happens a lot. So you're protected a lot by death. Death is your friend.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What about the benign tumor cells? Because they also have the same pattern, but they're not cancer.
Yeah, so polyps, a very good example of that. We'll hear on Friday a lot about colon cancer, right? So often colon cancer can start by a polyp. A polyp is a benign tumor, and it is a balance between growth and death. And when you lose death, you get a malignant tumor, right? So that's one way to get benign tumors, is this balance between growth and death.
So do you have
your genes that are lost because of that? I mean, that is to say, there's a particular mutation that changes your polyp into a carcinoma. Yeah. Okay, so hey, this is a pretty interesting experiment, right? And it actually has two parts to it. They're hidden in here, the two parts. One part is to do with the cell cycle, this slowing event, and mortality one. And one part is due to what happens in mortality two, what happens during this particular time. Right. So it's actually divided into two kinds of protections that you have based on this experiment. So I'm going to start off with, I could start off with either talking about the cell cycle, that is to say, how the cells divide and what are the negative regulators over cell growth that give you mortality one, right? Or I could actually start off, I think I will start off, with mortality two, where you get to a point where all hell breaks loose and your chromosomes fragment and they move around and so forth, right? I'll start off with that. So remember I told you had 23 chromosomes twice, right? So your chromosomes have the double-stranded DNA, I'll just screw it this way, right? And you have 3 times 10 to the 9th base pair, so you have really a megabase of DNA, 3 megabases of DNA, and you're divided up into these chromosomes, right? And these chromosomes are linear, right? Which presents a problem. Chromosomes don't have to be linear. The chromosome in this virus is a circle. So the DNA is actually a closed circle. That solves this problem that I'm going to tell you about. But any linear molecules have a big problem. And the big problem is they have ends. Now, why are ends a problem? And they're a problem, you have to understand, because of a totally different process called recombination. Right? If I have 2 homologous chromosomes, right, that means that this DNA strand is complementary to this DNA strand, right? And what could happen is, they can exchange, right? And if they exchange and register, everything's fine. But if they slip and exchange, then you've got a deletion in one and an addition in another, right? Or they confuse, right? And that is simply because N is a dangerous thing can invade, right? So just take my word for it, N's are an abomination in these situations, and the cell will do everything to not show its N's so it can invade, right? So what does the cell do to not show?
Why do you need open ends for that? Can the ring also open locally and then do the same?
The ring can be opened and then it can invade. Yeah. That's right. But it has to be open. That's an active process. Right? It's an enzymatic process then. Yeah. Or a gamma radiation event that breaks it. Yeah. Radiation is so dangerous actually because it breaks the DNA and it creates ends. And those ends that it creates, especially if it makes a double-stranded break, there's almost no way to repair it perfectly, right? So the repair processes are really critical to this whole thing as well. Right?
Can you indicate what ends are? I missed the part.
Ends invade. So ends give you a way to exchange. This end can invade here, and this is homologous to this, right? So it can invade there and exchange DNA. Did you see what I did? What I did was I took this guy, right? And I took this guy,
right? So you're melting
and reforming. That's right. That's exactly what I'm doing. I'm using hybrid base pairs to melt and reform, right? And then if I did that with the two chromosomes you have, one is from your father, one is from your mother, so they're non-identical, right? So you'd be exchanging or recombining information from your mother to your father with the chromosomes, right? Now you do that normally, actually, in sperm, when you make sperm and when you make eggs, and that's called recombination, and you have about 40 times every time you have an offspring, you get recombinations in your offspring, right? But that's because the process is regulated in the spermiogenesis and oogenesis. This is an unregulated process happening in your somatic cells, your fibroblasts in your skin, right? And this is... Yeah, so you have a lot of repetitive DNA. So when they match up, sometimes they go out of register, right? If you go out of register and you recombine, that means one of the chromosomes is going to get two copies of something and the other chromosome is going to have none, right? Because they've slid and recombined, right? And that's not good. You can imagine giving two copies to one offspring and none to another, the cells will die, right? And that's what they're doing. That's exactly what's happening here. They're recombining like hell because they have lots of ends that are broken, right? And these ends that get generated, right, are frail and they cause havoc with the cell. Most cells die when you get these copies. I remember I said a million cells die and one comes through.
So what part of cell cycle is part of this process?
Death. At the end, there's no cycle here, right? It's at the end of 80 generations. The cell cycle will never do this because the cell cycle is a normal growth pattern, right?
No, but even if there's a shift, but without a shift, it's a normal, when it's regulated.
No, you don't even get very much recombination during the cell cycle, right? Because there's no end. The ends are protected throughout the whole cell cycle. If you'll let me continue, I will get to the point where you'll see why the ends are generated here.
Why is it melting, why is it separating and recombining again?
So you have enzymes called helicases. Yeah, you have enzymes called helicases. Yeah. They unwind the helix.
And they do that all the time?
All the time.
Okay.
Right?
From ends? Is that the key?
They do it all the time, but it doesn't matter. You'll snap back if you have no ends, right? There's nothing to invade. If there's nothing to invade, you won't ever get a recombination, right? So that's why ends are dangerous.
What does invade mean?
Yeah. Invade means this strand is moving to that strand, right?
But why can't it do it with a section? Why do you need an end for
it? You need an end for it because it's getting started, right? If I have a closed circle, right? If I have a closed circle and I denature the DNA, I put in tertiary turns in the helix, right? Tertiary turns are very unfavorably entropically. It's thermodynamically impossible to continue to denature DNA that's closed, right? This is just Euclidean geometry, right? And so it's thermally impossible.
If you have ends, this end hybridizes over here occasionally, right? But if there are no ends, there's nothing to change the hybrid, make to hybridize with.
The analogy is a frayed rope, right? A frayed rope will open up by itself. There's a closed rope in
that. So the enzymatic...
Yeah, that's a good analogy. Yeah.
Is the enzymatic process begin at the end?
It's just
interesting. It has to terminate with the beginning.
No.
Two bundles. Okay.
Yeah. The enzymatic process can do this, right? An end can do that, right?
But you can do the same thing.
Oh, yeah.
Those nearby are both the same thing.
Yes, but if this is closed, completely closed, every time I do that, I don't get more than a little bubble. And the reason is I put tertiary terms, tertiary. I'm changing from secondary structure to tertiary structure, right? And at some point, you cannot denature the DNA anymore. You need to relax it to denature. You need to break it. That's right. It's those are the topoisomerases do that, right? Yes. Right. Is everybody getting back into students? Okay. All right. So I want you to come away with the correct impression. Actually, this was first found in plants. It was found by Barbara McClintock, who actually won a Nobel Prize for this. And all hell broke loose in these plants, and genetics just broke down completely, right? The genetics breaks down completely because things that are on chromosomes together no longer segregate together. You're moving genes around the whole genome, right? And that's what's causing this death, right? Now, let's take a look at what a linear chromosome looks like. These ends, I just told you, are ring death, right? And ends of chromosomes have a particular sequence, right? It's TTAGGG, right? And it's repeated a large number of times. That's AATCCC, right, on this side. And it's repeated thousands of times at the end, right? So these ends are actually even bigger disaster than I told you about, because since they're repetitive again and again and again, they slide all the time. Right? So this at this end of a chromosome is called a telomere because it has these sequences. These sequences attract a set of proteins. And if you look at their actual structure, the way these ends actually are, is they just switch these strands. They just fold back on themselves, right? And they actually then form a structure which comes to be called the telomere. Right? They're highly repetitive. They attract lots of proteins. The ends are now blocked, and everybody's very safe, right? Now, why does the chromosome do this? This is a sort of interesting problem. Why do you need a special end? Why are ends really bad, right? Why do you go to all this trouble, is really the question. Right? And the answer is in the property of the enzyme that synthesizes DNA polymerase. Okay? So I have to now tell you, I'll remind you, right, that DNA has a polarity. And it goes from 5' to 3', right? What that actually, so for the blank faces, what that actually means is that you have a base, you have a sugar, and you have a phosphate group. The phosphate group actually is linking all the bases together to what's called a phosphodiester bond, phosphate to sugar, phosphate to sugar, phosphate to sugar. The sugar is 5 carbons, it's a ribose, or deoxyribose for RNA and DNA, and the carbons are labeled 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. The 5' end with phosphates on it, right? 5' phosphate, or the 3' position with phosphate on it, is the linkage for DNA and RNA. 5 to 3, 5 to 3, 5 to 3, right?
You want to draw it, or is everybody...
This is a nice detail, but...
We didn't worry about it. Right?
The problem arises, right? So synthesis is always in one direction. Synthesis is in the 5' to 3' direction. Right? And for RNA synthesis, that's no problem. RNA starts de novo at a particular place. It's often called the promoter element. And it starts transcribing. Right? DNA can't start de novo. There's no way DNA starts de novo. So that's a problem with the enzyme. We don't understand why this enzyme won't do it, right? Because life would have been much easier if it would do it, right? But maybe there's a failsafe built in to not doing it, right? So that means that the only way DNA polymerase can actually start to work is to have a sugar here with a 3' hydroxyl group, and this is as a primer, right? So in order to start DNA synthesis, you have to have a primer. That's the way DNA synthesis proceeds, right? And it proceeds with a primer, and the primer is RNA. But when you finish, now you've got a problem. You can't fill in the RNA with DNA, right? So you lose the bases. So the chromosomes get shorter. You're losing your chromosomes from your ends. And you're losing them every time you divide, because you're actually dividing, you're synthesizing, duplicating your DNA once per cell division, right? Now,
but there are thousands of ends, so
you can. There actually are 46 ends.
I'm talking about 1,000 repeats of those.
Oh yes, yes. Oh yes, and that's why you can go. That's the reason you can go to each generation.
You also
only get 1,000. No. Because a primer is bigger than 6 base pairs. Just divide 80 into 1,000, right? And you'll get, right? 80 into 6,000, whatever you want. That's the length of the price.
So you're saying the age of animals proportional to the size of the strings?
Of the telomeres, yes. So, oh, that's true. Furthermore, suppose you get a couple of young people in the room, so I can get some people under the age of 5, right? And then I take the DNA from everybody here, and I measure your telomere length. Your telomere length will be proportional to your age.
Distribution.
It's a total distribution. When I measure lengths, here's what I see, right? Okay, so I'm going to measure lengths where this is the largest length and this is the shortest length, okay? And what you see if you do people of different ages is this. Right? The distribution. Everyone at every age you get a distribution, right?
So it's like a gel?
That's a gel. That is a gel.
So is it a
large to small? Yeah.
Gaussian.
That's right.
How long is the primer?
Well, the primer is, I don't know how long the primer is. The primer will be about 100 base pairs, a couple of hundred base pairs. You lose 100 to 200 base pairs. Primers, there's an enzyme called primase, and it doesn't have a single, it only too has a distribution of lengths, right?
So your replication of DNA cannot quite work like that because you cannot separate the whole DNA into, like, the whole chromosome into two
right.
strands.
Right.
One is continuously running, I remember.
So actually, the way it's working. Right. Is you have one continuous strand and one discontinuous strand, right? The continuous strand runs 5' to 3'. The discontinuous strand is the opposite polarity. And by discontinuous, I mean there's a primer here, there's a primer here, there's a primer here. But that's not a problem because it's in the middle, so I can fill it back in because I have a primer again, right?
So you throw away the primer and...
That's right, and just fill in the gaps, right? It's in the middle, so it's not a problem. It's at the ends you encounter the problem. Because there's no way to fill in the end without a primer, right? Okay, so now we've learned something about ends, right? Ends are special, right? They, in fact, have this special protected end. They have a special sequence, right? And you lose ends every division, right? And you get to a point where the ends no longer are protected, right? You've worn down your telomere
as you get older, to the point where it's no longer protected, and now the ends become recombinogenic. And this event, mortality too happens, right? Okay, so this brings up the same problem I mentioned to you, I referred to before. How do you ever have children? There's got to be a way to repair the ends, right? It's just you don't repair your ends in your somatic tissue, but in your germline tissue, you repair your ends, right? And you repair your ends with an enzyme called telomerase. Right? So there's actually an enzyme to repair the ends, and it's a very interesting enzyme. It comes with its own RNA primer. So it doesn't have to have an RNA primer that hybridizes to the end. It starts off with its own RNA primer and then copies the end, right? And so the ends in all your germ cells are repaired by telomerase, right? So I can now do an experiment that shows you that M2 is a telomerase defect, right? I could just take a clone, a gene for telomerase, and add it here, and I'll eliminate M2 and all the cells are doing it, right? Why? Because I just told you, you run out of ends, and then all catastrophe breaks loose, a million cells die, and a few clones come through. By the way, those clones that come through, all are expressing telomerase. Right? So every one of these clones that comes through is expressing telomerase. So 90% of cancers re-express telomerase, while normal cells that you have don't express telomerase. So that's one big change between cancer and normal cells. Right? And now you can see maybe the strategy that's involved. Right? The strategy here is, if I limit the division of your cells so they have a program that says the clock is over, right, I can shut down cancer by a million to one. Right? I have a million times chance of shutting down cancer, but at some frequency, a few cells will make telomerase and it will sneak through if you have enough cells.
About the 10% that don't have telomerase.
Yeah, I'll get to that. 10% don't have telomerase.
So in this process, there was some...
I introduced SV40. That's actually SV40. Allowing another 20 generations.
And that has the gene for telomerase or what does it do?
No, it does not. It does not, because you go into mortality too, right?
Right.
And that's telomerase.
So what are those viral?
Ah, that's the other part of the talk, right? That's the cell cycle, right? Mm-hmm. What SV40 does is allow you to continue division past the stopping. So mortality one is actually a very interesting point. It stopped before the all hell broke loose, right? It just stopped you, so that's what normally will happen in you. When your telomeres erode, the last thing we want to happen is have your chromosomes all scrambled, right? So there's something that stops it cold, right? That's going to be called the retinoblastoma protein and the P53 protein. And there are breaks on the cell cycle, and I'll talk about that in a minute. That's the cell cycle part of this talk, right? But the telomerase part is the second mortality step, and you can overcome it by just adding
telomerase. So it's E6 and E7.
E6 and E7 take care of retinoblastoma and P53. Right.
How does scrambling depend on the size of the tails? You said scrambling depends on the size of the end there somehow, this parameter. So is the shorter the tails, the probability of scrambling?
So that it is not that you completely remove the tails, right? Because I can still see by hybridization that you have tails, but you're getting awful close to old age here, and your cells are really stopped from dividing by the fail safes that are preventing the ends from uncovering right now, right? They're really at the end of their tether.
But there are two things. One is you don't have anything to grab on to start repeating, and the second is scrambling. I'm asking about the scrambling. Why is the tails
scrambling?
Well, you're showing that you...
You're having a lot of trouble figuring out why ends invade. That's what you're saying again. Tails are ends, right?
Right.
You don't really have ends in your chromosome because this telomere structure protects it so you never see the ends. It's as if you took this rope that he's talking about, and I held the ends in my two hands. by holding them in my two hands, I'm preventing them from fraying, right?
So how many amps do you need for this knot at the end? You're saying there's some kind of a knot at the end that prevents from...
Yeah. How many do you need? I don't really know the number, but you need enough to be stable. It's not a number. It's a distribution, and it is a probability that you're going to not have enough for the proteins to bind to. But I don't know the actual number of N's. There isn't a firm number, but this guy has N's, but he's at the end of his life.
Is there a sensing mechanism that senses
yes.
that cycle of S?
Yes.
So that you will go...
Yes, so there's a very critical sensing mechanism that says that your ends are too short and it stops the division process. That's called P53, right? That does that. Right? So there's a sensor that says your ends are too short, and the sensor is called the ATM protein kinase, and it actually signals to a way to stop division, right? And that's the pause you're all in if you're at a certain age in life where your cells are not dividing at a very robust rate.
Why does that cause death?
Well, you have to rejuvenate yourself. That's the strategy we mammals use, right? Today, you will have a billion new cells in your body. That will be your skin, your intestine, your blood. If you stop making those billion cells, you move only in one direction. Yeah.
What I didn't get is why
the strategy that we use. That's what gives us lifespan, by the way. You know, flies don't do that. Flies and worms, they don't rejuvenate themselves. They're mitotically stopped at birth, flies and worms. And they live 2 to 3 weeks. That's your choices.
What I didn't get is why the telomere cannot be extended again.
It can. It does. It's extended by telomerase. But you don't have telomerase in yourself. It's not expressed.
Okay.
Except for your testicles, where it is expressed, where you're making sperm.
Okay.
So your sperm have long telomeres, but they're the only cells in your body, except for a few T cells, that have long telomeres, right? So the strategy, it's a strategy, again, I'm going to take it as a strategy, right? The strategy is to shut down telomerase in all of your somatic cells, so that it will come here and stop, and not come here and cause cancer, right? It is better to stop dividing than to get cancer and start again, right?
But how about stem cells?
Yes.
Because they need to...
Stem cells actually are limited in their lifespan also. So for example, a very good example, the best stem cell we know of in your body is the bone marrow stem cell. It's called a CD34 bone marrow stem cell, right? You couldn't give a transplant to anybody. You're too old. So about the age of, I'm sorry. So about the age of 35 or 40, you don't transplant anymore, right? And the reason is that you're running out of telomeres in your CD34 stem cells.
Okay, but which is, how many times can they divide?
Well, think of it as a distribution in a population, right? So maybe any stem cell could divide, I'm going to guess, 80 times, right? 80 divisions, a lot of cells, by the way, right?
Yeah, but it's not much.
So did the 80. Right? Give us a calculator. Right? That's a lot. But then you have lots of stem cells. You may have a million CD34 cells, or 10 million, or 100 million CD34 cells, right? So you can have some stem cells resting while others are working. And as soon as the worker bees are running out of telomeres, the next guy comes in, right? And we see that. If I could mark your stem cells, I could watch them switching in the blood cells they make. And we do that in mice, of course, not in humans. But it's very easy to mark those stem cells and to ask the question, do you switch stem cells with time, with age? And the answer is yes, right? So here, let's just pause for a minute and go back to longevity, right? Because this is a question about how do we determine lifespan, right? Right? Maybe you determine lifespan by the number of stem cells you have, your length of telomeres. Telomeres actually shorten not only because of divisions. It's been shown recently that telomeres shorten because of stress, right? Which relates environmental factors to telomere shortening, right? So people who are chronically depressed
So people who have bipolar syndrome, for example, often at age match, what age, have shorter telomeres.
That's how?
Hmm?
How the stress?
Don't know that. Don't know that. But it's an interesting question. Maybe they have longer primers. Maybe they actually literally are
weak. Reflex primers can be shared.
Sure. But they haven't been bipolar people. I mean, people haven't checked the primer length in bipolar people.
Do you have higher turnover in them? Cell turnover is high?
You might. I don't know. Biological mechanism is unclear, but what is becoming clear is that influences over a lifetime, nutrition will influence over a lifetime, mental issues, right, all have a big impact on telomeres. There's a woman at UC San Francisco named Blackburn who works on this and who's working with psychiatrists now to ask questions about schizophrenics and bipolar individuals. So lots of the kind of environmental effectors could be affecting longevity here. Yes.
So I remember somehow from, so I cheated a bit, I read the Weinberg book.
Good.
That there was something, that's why I asked about mice and rats as well, because they actually do have expressed telomerase.
That's correct.
Although they live so short.
That's correct.
And if you somehow kill the telomerase, the mice keeps on living normally, the next generation it lives normally, and like after five generations.
Yes. So that's true. Different animals don't use the stress. I just read that thing. Different animals don't, I'm talking about humans, so make sure you understand it's humans. If I did the Hayflick experiment with mice, almost all the time the cells would come through and immortalize. They spontaneously immortalize at a very high rate. Right? So that humans don't spontaneously immortalize. They go through very strict, that's why I used humans, right? And also to be a little more anthropomorphic. But the mice will immortalize very fast. They immortalize very fast because they turn on telomerase very easily. And many cells in mice have telomerase on. So why do they live only 2 years? Right? First of all, the mice we use are really bizarre. They have the longest telomeres of any known animal. It is so long that I can knock out the telomerase gene. This is the experiment you're talking about. I knock out the telomerase gene in mice. And now it has no way to make germ cells, right? Except that it goes 4 or 5 generations before it runs out of telomeres. That's how long they are. About 5 generations worth of extra telomere length.
It's less than ours.
It's much more than ours. Much more than ours. It's the longest telomeres we know of. There's something that this is actually generations of animals, not generations of cells. Right, yeah.
How many cycles do regeneration run? For 1 generation?
I don't know.
Much less involved like 8
days. It's through the germline, it's not the somatic cells. It's through the germline. It's making sperm and eggs, right, without telomerase. Now, if you didn't have telomerase, I don't think you could make sperm. I mean, your sperm wouldn't work to fertilize an egg. But if a mouse doesn't, all mice, it's not even mice. I mean, if you capture a wild mouse, it does not have long telomeres. There's something peculiar about the mice we bred in our laboratories, right? They have extremely long telomeres, and when the result came through that nothing was wrong with them when you knocked out telomerase, you could see that the whole body of information that we thought was correct was suddenly stopped, right? Completely wrong, right? But all that had to happen was you keep the divisions going, and after 4 generations, then they collapsed. They could make no longer sperm or eggs, right? So there's something, so mice, this sort of observation is one of these biological oddities that we ignore. You know, there are things in physics, too, I'm sure you ignore because you don't like them, right? It's one of the things we ignore, so.
You divide the length of telomeres by the length of prime, you find out how many times they can divide. So
it sort of works. No one really does those experiments. You could. I mean, if you really feel they're important, you could.
Well, if this is the clock we're talking about, that it's just the length divided by length of prime, then this is...
You get a distribution, right?
Right.
And not everything stood. Yes, yeah. You'll get a number, but it'll be violated in the next animal. And no, it's not a number that we care to hang our hat on. That's all. Yeah, it's okay. I mean, you're right. And nothing you said was wrong. I'm just saying that it isn't something that people are rushing to do, so that there's a sort of a number. You know, it's not like the speed of light, right? It's not a great constant. It's not one of the great constants, right?
Is it not a great constant because you have enzymatic processes?
Yeah, it's a distribution, and I've already told you that diet and mental health and a whole bunch of other things affect lengths and things. And so the number of variables you're talking about that impinge upon what might have been a great constant threat, you know, might have been to say 100 base pairs is a length, and we live and die by that number, right? But it isn't true. We don't.
Well, you're also talking about a primer. When you're talking about a generic primer, or it's more of a distribution again.
No, a primer, if you measure the lengths of primers, which you can do, right? You can do it in cell culture, you can do it in vitro, right? You get a distribution for the lengths of primers, right? And if your nucleotide's concentration goes up tenfold, the distribution changes. And if I use an enzyme from a mouse or a human, I get a different distribution. So all these things don't make me want to do his experiment, right? I mean, I just don't want to do his experiment because there's too many sort of things that can change it, and what will it tell me, and what will I know, and I'm not going to know something that I can predict life from, right, or lifespan from.
Are you in your primary specific
in the region?
RNAs.
Yes, please, go ahead.
In the region where cell cycle...
I'm just moving you off of this sort of unproductive questioning, but go ahead.
It has nothing to do with universe.
Oh, good,
my
okay.
My question is, in the part of the cell cycle before you go into S1, where it's flat, I guess transition from G0 to G1 is regulated somehow,
yes,
by different processes.
And that's where I'm going now. That's why I'm moving on. Yes. Okay. So I just told you. Sorry. Go ahead, please. Yeah.
Coming back to the stem cell question.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Second.
Sure. That's a very interesting question.
Sure, I got that.
Yeah.
How a distribution of stem cells, and do I correctly understand they sleep or rest most of the time? Because otherwise I would never, ever make it to...
You correctly understand. Most stem cells are in rest most of the time, and they're called out by growth factors and nutrients and the absence of feedback from the product of the stem cells, right? So there's a very integral feedback. So when one stem cell fatigues and is not making its product, right, that feedback brings the second stem cell out. Right? And you can keep that up for as long as you have stem cells. Right? So life isn't just measured by the telomeres. Life is measured by the telomeres times the number of stem cells that can contribute on, right?
It was just
exactly. Yeah. Yes.
In the feature that we gave for the shortening of the telomeres, always one copy remains the same.
Remember what you're doing. What I did was I'm going in this direction and this direction. So I'm losing it from this strand, I'm losing it from this strand, so both strands are lost, right? Remember, this is the three to five, this is the rate of synthesis, right? I'm losing it from this end because that had an RNA, right? And I'm losing it from this end. So the two strands, when they separate, I'm going to lose it from both ends.
Sure, from both ends of...
Of two strands.
One strand and the new copy is missing a part.
That's correct. The new copy is always missing a part. The old copy is fine. That's right. Yes. But of course, most by the time you get through 10 generations, almost everybody's new, right? There's only two cells that are old, right? And even those cells have lost half the... issue. Yeah.
Before you move on, sure. Can I just ask you questions about the tissue culture hay flicks experiment?
Yeah.
So those are done in optimum tissue culture conditions, and we now know that cancer cells are in low pH or low oxygen conditions. So if you were to redo the experiment,
yes,
what kind of changes?
Yeah. So it's correct. This is the state of the art 1960s. State of the art starting to change. One of the problems that we've always had in tissue culture is that the cells in your body are quite hypoxic compared to the cells we have in tissue culture. We have too much oxygen in tissue culture. Too much oxygen causes damage. Too much damage will actually slow the rate of division and slow the rate of these cells. And so you can repeat these experiments in anoxic conditions and the lower, and you'll get an extended lifespan, but the same thing happens. I mean, nothing, no fundamental rules change, but times change, right? It's another reason why I'm not so excited about measuring primer lengths and things, is because these things are flexible by changing environmental conditions. But when the rules I've told you are still rules. So the principles are the important thing. The time, 80 generations, is not so important, right? That's the take-home message of the sort of more the modern synthesis of this. Okay, so now this M1, right? Why did they stop the first time? And what protects us from getting into telomere death, right? M1 is a protection for telomere death, right? So for this, we have to learn a little bit about cell cycle. And it's the uncovering of two molecules. I have to apologize to our cell biology friends here, because I'm now moving from cells to molecules, right? And that's because these molecules are the ones that protect these cells from moving to telomere death. And they turn out to be probably the two most important tumor suppressor genes that we have that protect us from cancer. So that's why I say this is a lot like the Feynman experiment. This is a fundamental experiment that keeps uncovering things for us, right? Okay, so let me just say a few words about the cell cycle. So conventionally, it's called the cell cycle because division just keeps repeating. And there are four parts to the cell cycle. And it all started with what you could see and what you couldn't see. So there's a part of the cell cycle which is called S phase for synthesis, right? And it's for DNA synthesis. So there's a part of the cell cycle for DNA synthesis. I'm going to give you a number in a minute that you can count on, okay? All right. So there are, when you double the DNA, right, you do so in 6 hours, right? Okay. But the rate of synthesis of DNA polymerase, that's the enzyme I told you about, right? The rate of synthesis is 50 base pairs per second. That's the optimum rate of synthesis, right? 50 base pairs per second would take years to make one round of DNA, right? Okay? So now these numbers you can count on because these are measured at optimal conditions, and this is a rate of synthesis, right? So that is going to tell you that there has to be a prop. So if the average rate is 6 hours, and I can get that rate down to 2 hours, actually, in embryos, in an embryo, after fertilization, division is so fast that DNA synthesis occurs in 2 hours, right? Even though the rate of synthesis, base pairs per second, stays the same, right? And the reason for that, actually, is what was said before about DNA replication. It's a kind of interesting issue. We actually, if this is the chromosome, we actually don't start at one end or the other end and go in. We start all over the chromosome and have origins of replication. So these bubbles are the duplication processes. So now you can go 50 base pairs per second, but the number of origins change, right? So in an embryo, the number of origins is much higher than it is in an adult. And it's a very interesting question, what's an origin, how do you find it, how do you know how many to start, how do you know how many, how long is S phase, right? But let me just tell you, S phase is flexible by the number of origins you have, okay? Now, then there's mitosis, which is 1 hour, okay? And mitosis is easy to see under the microscope, it's where the chromosomes condense and they separate and an equal number of chromosomes go to each new cell. Right? So these two were pretty easy to see, right? And this phase between mitosis and S phase became called gap one. And this phase between S phase and M phase called gap two, right? And gap two is really preparation for mitosis, and gap one is preparation for S phase.
How much variation do you have in mitosis? Is that always
so one mitosis hour? Is always about an hour. It can't be, it could be a little faster than an hour, but it can't be much faster than an hour. And mitosis is a pretty rate limiting process.
Can you say something about the bubbles? A little more about the bubbles?
The bubbles. The bubbles are the origin of replication. I didn't make a big deal of it, but replication is bidirectional. So actually, an origin is where things start, right? And so a primer is laid down here, right? And you synthesize, right? Now, when I lay down a primer, I actually lay down a primer at the end, actually. Right? So I'm synthesizing in one direction. This, now, I lay down primers in a discontinuous fashion, right? And they finally merge, right? And I then erase the RNA and fill in the primer by using this DNA as the primer, right? So the origins are actually in the middle, and replication goes in two directions. I mean to draw it this way, actually. Right? From the origin.
So don't use the ends.
No, you ultimately you have to fill in the ends, right? So you do need the ends. It's just that it occurs all over the chromosome, and the only time you have a problem is at the ends, right? Because at the ends you can't fill in the primers anymore, right? There's no extra space out there to link a primer to. And that's why the ends are getting shorter, even though the middles are fine. Okay? So now, what is gap one is a completely flexible time. In embryos, it's 0 hours. There is no G1. So it goes MS, 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 right? MSG2, MSG2. And that's one of the ways you really shorten down to about 6 or 7 hours or 8 hours of division time, right? So embryos divide very rapidly. And actually, if you reprogram cells, they divide very rapidly. Right? And sometimes cancer cells divide very rapidly. Not always. Sometimes they divide slowly, sometimes rapidly, but they have this chance to be rapid. Right? Okay. Now, a very interesting... Yes?
First.
Okay. So, people started to explore what happens in G1. Right? So, I'm now going to just draw the cell cycle this way. G1, S, G2, M. Right? And I'm going to draw S phase that like this. So I'm measuring the amount of DNA. This is rate of DNA synthesis. So the rate of DNA synthesis peaks during S phase and then declines, right? Okay. So remember I told you, now we'll go back to this growth factor issue. All your cells are resting. And they need two kinds of signals to decide to divide. When cells are dividing, they've got to make sure they have enough nutrients to make all the components of a cell 2x, right? Well, S phase takes care of DNA, but lipids, carbohydrates, proteins, rate of protein synthesis, all these things are monitored. There are, you'll see the monitors, we'll talk in fact probably tomorrow about the monitors of the cell cycle. That's why it's good to introduce the cell cycle early. The monitors of the cell cycle break apart when it comes to cancer. Right? And these are all monitored. And right here at the zero time, right, two signals are gotten. One is the signal for nutrients, glucose and glutamine. So glucose and glutamine are the two critical substrates to make everything in the cell. Right? And that's this metabolic question we could get into in Iguazu tomorrow. The metabolism of cancer cells is different than the metabolism of normal cells. In fact, the metabolism of cancer cells is just like embryos and wound healing and the immune response and cancer. Those are four commonalities. And you use a completely different metabolic strategy for those four processes than you do for maintenance phase. You're in maintenance phase now. Right? In maintenance phase, you're optimizing the amount of energy you're using by making ATP from glucose. You're going to get about 36 ATPs out of a mole of glucose. Right? And in the high growth phase, you actually reduce that. but you take in 10 times more glucose. So there's
nutrients
are measured. There's a measuring stick for nutrients in the cell. And then I told you need a growth factor. So I told you about platelet-derived growth factor. It comes from platelets. It's important for wound healing, right? But there's something called epidermal growth factor. In fact, there are 5 epidermal growth factors. But there's something called fibroblast growth factor for fibroblasts. There's lots of different kinds of growth factors for lots of different kinds of cells, right? And they have specificity at receptors that are on cells. They gain their specificity by the receptors on cells. So almost all your cell types have receptors, and then there's growth factors, right? Let me tell you, these receptors and growth factors are some of the biggest players in cancer. When they're overproduced, the signals are constantly on to grow, and that's half the battle, right? Remember I said fast growth and no death, right? Okay, so you have growth factor plus glucose and glutamine, and then a very interesting thing happens. A molecule starts to be synthesized in response to these signals. And that molecule is called cyclin B. Right? Okay. Now, it's not a difficult time period for people. And the reason it's difficult is that the nomenclature now is going to start to fall. I mean, I could do everything pretty conceptually here, but now there's lots of terminology, and every one of these things is a gene. Let me give you an example. There are 3 cyclin Bs, called D1, D2, D3. For breast tissue, there's cyclin D1. 13% of breast cancers have amplified the cyclin D1 gene. Right? That tells you immediately that amplification means many copies. That's due to this unequal crossing over that we talked about. Many copies of cyclin D1, 13% of breast cancers, they're being driven by this growth, right? So don't worry about memorizing anything, just sort of take it in as a concept, right? So cyclin D is made, and then it's degraded. And that's followed by cyclin E. And that's followed by cyclin A. Always made and degraded. That's why they're called cyclins, right? They're cycling at specific times. That's followed by cyclin B. This is A. Right? Cyclins are subunits of enzymes called protein kinases. Protein kinases are enzymes that take a phosphate group and they phosphorylate a target, right? They're subunits because there's a catalytic subunit, which is called cyclin-dependent kinase 4-6. And these two things come together, right? And they make a protein kinase. And they phosphorylate a target, and that moves the cell cycle along, right? Cyclin E works on CDK2, right? Another protein kinase. Actually, cyclin D phosphorylates cyclin E, among other things. Cyclin E, CDK2, CDK1. Right? So there are 4 sets of cyclins which are going up and down, right? And they are activating a protein kinase, which is moving a pathway along through the cell cycle. And you can show, by just knocking these out, that cyclin D, CDK4 is absolutely essential to move through G1. You can show that cyclin E is absolutely essential to move through G1 into S phase. Cyclin A is absolutely essential to move through S phase. Cyclin B, CDK1, absolutely essential to move through G2 and into M, and in M phase, right? So these are essential parts of the trigger, the pathway, that's regulating the cycle, right? I haven't told you about the targets yet. Yeah?
Is there a specific number of phosphorylation that correlates with each of these?
Yes. You'll see. It's a very clever strategy when I finally can lay it all out to you. But I have to introduce you to the players. Right?
sorry, and the cyclin 1, cyclin 2, these are different tissue specific?
No, these are different cell cycle time specific. They're actually in every cell.
Yeah.
So,
so you said cyclin
1
specific?
So D1 is in breast, and D2 may be in another tissue, and D3 is in another tissue. So, actually they would substitute for each other in knockouts, right? So they have a broad tissue specificity, but it's not absolute. That's why I don't think it's really worth worrying about how many different isoforms of these. They're really separate genes, right? Yeah.
And that's why the phase G1 can take different time?
That's correct, yeah, because you could synthesize it rapidly or short time, right. And cyclin D1 actually is measuring the amount of nutrients you have. It's one of the measurements for the amount of nutrients through this growth factor signaling. And that measurement for the amount of nutrients you have is very important for how fast you want to move this through, right? Because you may want to have to take a longer time to utilize the nutrients if they're at low concentration. Okay, so what's the target of these guys? Because it's not enough to say the protein kinases cycle. They have to have a target that really is regulating the cycle and actually stopping in mortality 1 cells, right? This is now what's happening as these cells divide, right? Okay, so there's a great so the target was found in a totally different way. And it was a great experiment by a guy named Alfred Knudsen, who was at MD Anderson in Houston at the time. And he was a pediatrician and an epidemiologist, right? So this is really different kind of science than anything we talked about before. He's looking at kids, right? And he's trying to figure out something about cancer in kids. So he's looking, he's looking at childhood cancers, he's looking at a disease called retinoblastoma. So that's right. Okay, retinoblastoma. This is a tumor of the retinoblast. So the retina is made, and when it's made by a precursor cell called the retinoblast, which ultimately makes a retinal cell. And the retinal cells, the retinoblasts, persist for about 5 or 6 years of life, and then they stop dividing, and then your retina is fixed. That's why if you looked at the sun too long for the eclipse, and you burn out retinal cells, they'll never regenerate because you have no more retinoblasts after 5 or 6, right? So retinoblasts are the cells that these kids get as tumors. And what you saw when they were born, you could see some kids who were actually born with the tumor and other kids who got it later. So he found out there were two groups of kids, right? So group number one, first of all, are born with the tumor. If they're born with the tumor, it's always in both eyes. And if always in both eyes, it's always multiple tumors. So if there's one group of kids who, at birth, you could look in their eyes and see the tumors, and you'd see in both eyes multiple tumors. Right? Then there's a second group of kids that get the exact same tumor, right? But they get it at 4 to 7 years old. Right? They get it in one eye, and they get one tumor. Right? So his problem was he had the exact same cancers in two different presentations. So if there's a cause for this, and it's the same cause, how does that come about? This is a great place to pause and let you guys solve the problem, because he made a hypothesis which turned out to be absolutely correct. It's really great. This is pure, this is like theoretical physics. You get a few facts, right? You sit and think about it, you make a hypothesis, and then you wait 20 years for some experimentalist to actually show it's right, right? Well, that's exactly what happened here. He waited about 15, 20 years for an experimentalist to show that his hypothesis was right. So how does one mechanism account for these two tumors? It's really the question. This is good, because I'm not going to go on until someone answers.
It could be 15 or 20 years.
Here's what he said. So you have two copies of this gene, right? I'll call it the retinoblastoma gene. Kids with number one, born with tumors, both eyes, multiple tumors, they inherit one copy which is defective. And then with a probability of 100%, there's a mutation in the second copy. This is going to kill you when I tell you how this mutation arises. It arises through recombination, so be careful. Right? 100% probability the mutation arises, and so you require two copies lost, right, to get the tumor. But if you inherit one, it's the probability of getting it is 100%. Right? Well, these people don't inherit the tumor, right? So they've got to get two spontaneous mutations. This occurs 1 in 10,000 kids because it's a rare event. To get two independent mutations is a rare event because it's the product of the mutation rates. Mutation rates are about 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 8 here.
What determines the number of tumors in the eye? In the first case,
it's being determined by the fact that there are many places in which the retinoblastoma mutations have occurred in both copies. So that's what he's hypothesizing. He's saying you've got to get two independent mutations to occur in both alleles, in both of the genes that you carry, right? So that means what's dominant is normal, right? Because if you had a heterozygote, it'd be normal. You need two independent mutations, right?
The left case is familial.
Right? The left case is familial, it's inherited, and the right case is not familial. So he would say, since it's familial, that the parents would have had this as well. And you could tell that right away. Yeah.
I don't quite understand the argument because in the first case, the notion is if you have one, right, then...
You're waiting for a second mutation, right?
Well, I thought you said that the central probability one, you get the second...
Hit with a probability of actually about 10 to the minus third. And since you have about 10 to the eighth or 10 to the ninth cells in your retina, that's the problem, right? Is the number of cells in the retina, the probability gets high that you have five tumors, right? It's the number of cells that gives you the extra dimension, right?
Can you go through, I'm still through this math,
yeah.
How you get from 10 to the 5 times 10 to the minus 3, you get number of tumors doesn't quite match.
Yeah.
Can you read it slow?
Doesn't quite match. Okay. So if I have 10 to the 9th cells, right? Okay, and and every cell has one mutant, right? One mutation, right? And the mutation rate is 10 to the minus 8. I will have 10 cells with mutations in both, right? See the math? Yep. So that means that everybody will get it because they're 10 to the 9th cells.
They'll give you the number of tumors.
10.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, but again, mutation rate is a stochastic event. It could be 5, it could be 3, it could be, right? But that's right. So, but it will always be 100% have second copies, and the mutation is in the second copy, and it will always be that you'll have multiple tumors, right? And both eyes.
10 to the minus 8 comes from where?
10 to the minus 8 is the mutation rate.
For a particular
gene. Okay, for any gene, right? So this gene is 1 in 10 to the 8th, and there's 10 to the 9th cells, and one copy's gone already, right? But you can see that it would be 10 to the minus 16th here, right? In the other guy, right? So you don't have 10 to the 16th cells in the retina, right? So that is going to take something in the neighborhood of 1 in 10,000 kids.
Well, but it gives 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 7, which is not, it's kind of below.
The second part, yes. Let's go over the second part, right? So 1 in 10,000 kids. So,
from your numbers, you get to the minus 16.
Depends on whether it's minus 7 or minus 8 or minus 7. Depends.
Minus 8 or minus 7, it's not, yes. Not minus 4.
Doing order of magnitude calculations.
Yeah.
Right. Can you computer gets slow.
Okay, I got one of 10,000. That's 10 to the minus 3, 4, 5, right? I've got 10 to the 5 kids, right? And I've got 10 to the, what did I say, 10 to the 9th cells. I'm making this up as I go along, right? So it's 10 to the 14th, right? And if the mutation rate was 10 to the minus 8 for the first mutation, right? You're going to actually like this, because I'm going to drop the mutation rate for the second mutation. That's why you're going to like it, right? So this is 10 to the minus 16th, right? And you're saying, gee, 10 to the minus 14th is not 10 to the minus 16th, right? But it doesn't occur that way. It actually occurs by, the second mutation occurs by recombining and copying the first mutation onto the second chromosome. Yeah. Remember recombination? Yeah. Right? So the mutation rate for the second hit goes up. The rate at which it occurs, right? Well, by a lot, actually. It goes up by 10. Magnitude, so you get 10 tubers, right? So once it happens, you're in trouble, because the second mutation occurs at a higher rate. I'm going to show you how they prove this, since you really want to know, right? Maybe you don't. Okay, so let us take a hard look at how they demonstrate. So that was his hypothesis. His hypothesis is there's two kinds of kids, one that inherits and then gets a second, and that's this group, and one that's spontaneous and then gets a second, and that's this group, right? So they found the gene. They cloned the gene for retinoblastoma. This is Bob Weinberg and another guy named Wenhua Li. They found the gene for retinoblastoma. They took the gene from these first set of kids, and they took it from the blood cells, and they found the mutation. That means it's inherited, it's in the blood cells, right? Then they looked at the tumor and they found the second mutation. The second mutation is identical to the first. It's copied, it's not spontaneous. It's identical to the first. Secondly, all of the markers around it showed that it's a copy of the other chromosome. All of the genetic markers, right? So it's actually copied at a very high rate, right? So that was the first time we tended to see recombination copying one chromosome off another. And when it happens, when there's a cancer from a clone, right, clone of cells, it happens here. Right? Here, 1 in 10,000 kids get a mutation. This happens sometime early in development or early in life. It's copied on the second, and they get a tumor. Right? Same gene, same effect, same double hit, right? It's just the timing, whether it's inherited or not. Right?
So 10 to the minus 8, a copy mutation on the brain.
You worry about all the wrong things. just worry about the concept. Both of them are copied mutations. It doesn't matter whether it's spontaneous or inherited. Once you have a first, the second one has the exact same read across kilobases of DNA from the other copy. Yeah.
I'm just asking about grades. It's 10 to the minus 8 rate for the corporate.
No, copy's about, it's even lower. That's the first.
But then when you go to 10, you just 10 to the minus 8, 10 to the minus 9. Don't
worry about it. Right? So the second kind of kids, right, the group 2, uh-huh. we generate the first mutation at 10 to the minus 8. Right. Right? The second one is a high probability because of the gene conversion.
I'm asking the first one now.
He's asking for numbers, so I'm going to give him numbers. 10 to the minus 5th. I'm giving you an answer. 10 to the minus 8th is a spontaneous rate. 10 to the minus 5th is a copy rate.
So why don't you use 10 to the minus 8th for the first part?
Let's discuss it. So in both groups, the mutations are the same in both alleles.
Exactly. In both alleles, which tells you that it's not spontaneous, right? That's right. Okay. All right. Now, what the heck is retinoblastoma, right? It obviously is involved in this tumor, right? But it is the target of, cyclin D. Right? It is the target of cyclin E, right? Remember I said these are protein kinases. They phosphorylate something, which allows you to move on, right? What happens is the following. This is a very climactic moment, and then we'll call it a morning. We'll do P53 this afternoon. The retinoblastoma protein sits in the nucleus of the cell, and it binds a group of transcription factors. Transcription factors are the proteins that bind to DNA and allow the genes to be expressed for the first time, transcribed. And they are called, I'm just going to give you the simple, E2F. Right? When retinoblastoma binds to E2F, E2F is off. Okay? So in the steady state of no division, on your chromosomes sits E2F on the DNA and retinoblastoma on the E2F, and your gene is off. Right? What genes are we talking about? We're talking about all the genes that prepare you to go into S phase. Okay, what is that? DNA polymerase. Primase, that's the enzyme that primes. Ligase, the enzyme that ligates, right? All the enzymes that make the nucleotides. All the enzymes that make the nucleotides are synthesized by E2F. E2F is this magic transcription factor that moves the cell from G1 to S phase by making all the enzymes that prepare everything for DNA synthesis and then allowing DNA synthesis. And all of it's regulated by the retinoblastoma protein in the off condition. Okay? So a very nice thing happens now. Cyclin D CDK4 phosphorylates the retinoblastoma protein. So as it goes up, right, it phosphorylates the retinoblastoma protein and some of the E2F becomes free. Right? So that's the target. This is this cycling enzyme that's watching the nutrients is now for the first time phosphorylating at free E2F, and some enzymes are made. E2F makes cyclin E, CDK2. That's the next guy, right? And what's the target? RB. And the rest of the E2F goes off, right? Now, watch what happens in this particular case. If you have something that phosphorylates RB, that makes E2F, that now makes E, right? And it phosphorylates RB again, right? It no longer needs D, right? And in fact, by the time you get both of these made, right, all of the E2F is free and you are committed completely to S phase. At that point, I can take glucose and glutamine out. I can starve the cells, it will go through the whole cell cycle. So this period of time is to store everything I need to complete division. And this RB is called the restriction point, and it's regulated by ECDK2 and DCDK4, right? Yeah.
So is that also the time storing, meaning in the sense that it stores volume?
Yeah, yes, it
so
doubles
the,
mass.
The growing in size, except probably for embryonal cells where you reduce size, happens during G1 phase. Yeah.
So cells will not divide unless they have a certain mass. And they measure mass in G1 and make the commitment at the retinoblastoma point, right? And they are measuring mass by these cyclins, upstream of those cyclins. They're measuring their rate of protein synthesis, which is their major mass component. It's actually ribosomes, right?
So they're measuring mass or concentration?
No, they're measuring mass.
How
they weigh it. You said how, and I told you they weigh it.
What is the mechanism that senses the weight?
It's the mechanism is actually sensing the rate of protein synthesis, right? No, it's ribosome. It's measuring the amount of ribosomes being made.
Are they convincing volume measurement? I couldn't find convincing volume measurement. Mass, I agree, but it's not
mass.
Yeah, but I couldn't find for volume.
cells will not get too small. Although they get, so if you make mutations in ribosomal proteins, which slow the rate of ribosome biogenesis, something like 80% of the mass of the cell is ribosomes. Ribosomes are really a large component in the cell. So the rate of synthesis of ribosomal RNA and ribosomal proteins is really the mass of the cell, right?
Times time,
yes.
But they degrade also, right? So.
Yeah.
But it's time.
Oh. Again, it's this normal cycle, the cycling D and RV and
what's it
called?
Yeah, so.
I think so
what's happening is you start off by having a sensor. I'll go through the to get you to the sensors, I have to get to something called the insulin-like growth factor pathway, so I'm not there, right? But you have a set of sensors. Don't worry about what sensor, right? That measures glucose and amino acids, right? That's the nutrient sensors. Then you need a growth factor, right? The growth factor engages a receptor, it engages a signal transduction pathway, and turns on the synthesis of cyclin D, right? So that's how cyclin D gets started once both of these are measured, right? Now I have cyclin D rising.
This is by transcription.
That's all by transcription, that's correct.
It measures concentration. It measures concentration of levels.
Concentration of
glucose and
the sensors.
It's actually measuring AMP, and it's measuring AMP dependent upon the enzyme that AMP stimulates. It's called AMP kinase. So it's measuring a concentration of AMP. But since the volume of the cell is roughly the same, right? Right? The mass of AMP or the pool size of AMP is what it's measuring, yeah. Right? So
cyclin D is transcribed.
Cyclin D is transcribed, right? DCDK4 phosphorylates RB. That allows some E2F to be made, which transcribes cyclin E, right? It also transcribes the ubiquitin ligase for cyclin D, so it gets degraded, right? The first step, it carries with it the seeds of its own destruction, but also the seeds of the next step's synthesis. So the next step synthesis starts, which is ECDK2, right? That finishes the phosphorylation of RB, right?
It's a kinase.
They're both kinases. They both have the same substrates, but they have different phosphorylation sites on the protein, right? Right? Yes, so if you think of E2F being released in two steps, step one is for high affinity binding constants, step two is for low affinity binding constants, and step two brings you all the enzymes that are needed for S-phase, right? When retinoblastoma is completely phosphorylated, right? What happens at that point is that you're irrevocably committed to go through SG2M. Nothing stops it, right? All nutrients have been measured. All the sensors that measure, mass of the cell, right? Measuring the rate of protein synthesis. You'll see, when I talk about P53, you'll see there's a second player here, and it's measuring the mass here by the rate of ribosome synthesis, right? All of that is measured here and commits to S phase. Once that's committed, you go. Irrevocably gone, right? And you then degrade cyclin E and start cyclin A, which is needed for S phase, and another set of enzymes that get you into G2, another set of enzymes that get you into M, right? So there's a series of events which trigger the next set of events, and each of them is checked. Right? Each of them has a check on it, right? I haven't given you the checks yet, right? And it's a little late to give them to you, so I'm going to do it this afternoon. We'll go back over this. But at each of those four stages, cyclin D, cyclin E, cyclin A, and cyclin B, there are checkpoints, right? And those checkpoints say stop. A disaster is about to happen. Stop. Right? So if in the middle of your replication cycle you suddenly were irradiated and the DNA broke, and all hell would break loose if you tried to replicate a damaged template, right? It'll stop. Right? So that's why you set up a series of events like this that have one dependent upon the previous one and degrading the previous one, right? Dependent and degrading, right? Because each of these is going to have checkpoints that are going to try to prevent errors. Everything I've now told you is going to lead to fidelity, right? You want fidelity in the replication process. Right? And that's what we'll talk about next. That's the role of the second protein. So the retinoblastoma protein, right? Here, right? One of the things that's actually happening here is all these checkpoints are clicking in, right? So cyclin D is inhibited here. Cyclin E is inhibited here, right? It's the checkpoints have clicked in and stopped the process. And everything stops because retinoblastoma is no longer phosphorylated here because the cyclins are being inhibited, right? By processes which occur with aging, right? With divisions. And those processes are feedbacks from the telomere length. Or DNA breaks. But this is why the hypoxia issue is an important issue. You get breaks in high oxygen, right? So I'm moving back to concepts rather than technical terms, right? But the first big player here in M1 is retinoblastoma. It is the go-no-go step. It's often called the restriction point, and it is the go-no-go step. It was actually hypothesized to exist by an epidemiologist and shown to be a correct hypothesis, right? So it's a good example of theory in biology, yeah.
And in the mutated case, is it simply then that the retinoblastoma doesn't bind ever to the E2F, and so you just, whatever's transcribed due to E2F being free just
you got
continues?
It. You got it. Okay. In the mutated case, I'm going to say one other thing, so I'll give you a clue for this afternoon when we talk about viruses. Viruses carry with them ways to inactivate RP. Why? Because they want to throw the cell into cycle. Why do they want to throw the cell into cycle? They want to synthesize their own DNA, right? So viruses have picked this point as the point to reverse, right? And you'll see human viruses do that. I mean, they're cervical cancer and head and neck cancers are caused by the virus that inactivates retinoblastoma protein, right? And when it inactivates it, the E2F is free, and now it just functions. There's almost like no G1, right? Just no G1. Everything's just replicating, right? Yeah.
You know, some cells grow into G0, so how does that fit in this picture?
Yeah. So I haven't mentioned G0. So at the end, this cell cycle is for just cycling cells, and sometimes cells go into rest. Now, we recognize a state called G0 only because it takes longer to get from the end of M to the next S phase if you go out of cycle, right? So there must be something that allows you to go out of cycle and rest and then come back in cycle and go through this, right? So RB acts right here, right? And it still acts right there, right? So there are signals at the end of M, right? Good example is that, for example, the rate of protein synthesis that starts up is too low. It'll never manufacture enough proteins to double the mass of the cell, right? So the cell decides to go into rest. It shuts everything down and goes into a true rest, right? Now, we don't understand a lot about the G0 stage. There are some new proteins been made. The cell has actually shut down the rate of protein synthesis. We don't understand how it's called out, right? So I can't tell you a lot about it. It's just inferred to exist as a state and it's inferred to exist as a state because of this extra time period that it sits there. Now, stem cells that we talked about that sit for years, that could sit for years in your bone marrow, right? Those stem cells would be said to be in G0, right?
That's what saves us.
That's right. That may be in the end what saves us, and we know so little about it that I can't even tell you more. Not even a before lunch conversation, yeah.
And the time stays in G1, can that be manipulated by feeding or
correct.
Nutrition
yes.
supply?
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's right. So if I decided to lecture right through lunch and you didn't have lunch, we'd slow your rate of division down. You'd think more slowly, you'd see more slowly, you wouldn't have enough ATP, right? That's why I'm trying to get to lunch. Yes, but absolutely. So the length of time of G1 is all about the sensors of glucose and amino acids, right? Yeah.
But then G0 really is the key thing.
G0 is an important thing we know very little about. That's right. A key thing, I don't know, but an important thing we know little about. We could probably agree G0 is important, yes. Okay, let's take a break. We're meeting at 2. And at 2, we'll do the next. And I will work with you through lunch to get the calculations correct.